Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Chet Haas from the Toolkit team.
I'm Tor Norby from the Android Developer Tools team.
And today we have...
Hi, I'm Phil Weaver from the Accessibility team.
Phil has been doing accessibility for Android or accessibility in general for what, the last 6 or 7 years?
5 at Google.
Okay. I was one of the people that interviewed Phil, and he still doesn't remember that. So I'm quite proud of that.
I'm sure it's for the best that I don't remember that.
It was a stunning interview. Anyway, so you joined Google to work on the overall accessibility team, which handles accessibility stuff for Android as well as other things. And then you moved over to the Android platform, Android framework team, what, a couple of years ago?
3 years ago.
Okay. And now you're Mr. Accessibility for Android Framework. And what does that mean?
I think the core of that is to try to make sure that accessibility works for as many people as possible with sort of as little effort as possible from everyone outside of Android accessibility. As we know that developers want to do the right thing for users with disabilities, but they have a lot of different pressures on them. And so we want to make sure that we may ask as little as we can from them to make sure that that stuff still works for the people we're trying to serve.
So that would be things like what? What are things that developers don't have to do that the platform can then do to sort of surface accessibility data?
So there's a lot of just data that we collect from the framework. When you go to put the UI on the screen, even if you're not thinking about accessibility, you're still telling Android lots of things. Like, you want this view to have this specific position. So we know the bounds of it. Mm-hmm. If you're displaying text, we're rendering the text for you. So we know what that text is, where it is. If you've registered on-click listeners, we can identify that this is a clickable thing. So we can annotate that accessibility information correctly. But there's some things we can never do. Like, if you display an image of something to try to convey some piece of meaning, it's impossible for us to know for sure what that meaning really is.
Don't you mean possible with machine learning?
Yeah, that's something we've thought about. But that's why I said it's never going to be possible to do it perfectly.
Yeah. Like,
you can get into doing cool machine learning things, and we may be able to do that at some point and get some idea. But it's easier if somebody just tells us what they mean. And that is a string that we call a content description. So that's sort of like our most basic ask of developers, is when they're using images to convey information, to also just explain what that is in a content description.
In exactly 1,000 words, too, because that's what a picture is worth.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's one of the requirements.
So that's for someone who is, sight impaired. Is there something equivalent for other sort of impairments? For example, you know, when I watch TV, there's captioning, and it'll say, oh, they're playing, and they'll like list the music or say, hey, there's, you know, distant jackhammer in the background or whatever. Is there something you do to sort of label other types of application data?
So for captioning, there's another API people can use if they're going to have content that might need to be captioned.
Okay.
That's just basically a set of preferences for how the user would like to see the captions.
Okay.
For other labeling, I guess rather than there being an issue with specifically labeling things, sometimes it's a matter of identifying actions or making sure that actions, like if somebody's registered an on-click listener on everything, that starts to be confusing for somebody with a motor impairment, where we may offer, like, do you want to click on this? It's clickable. Do you want to click on that? It's clickable. And if everything on the screen is clickable, we end up asking them if they want to click on a bunch of stuff that doesn't make sense. And if they say yes and nothing happens, then they get confused. So there are ways to, things that really don't have any effect on visually impaired users that still can be accessibility issues.
Yeah, that reminds me of an issue we ran into in the IDE. So I work on Android Studio. And
really?
You know, yes, oh, I might have mentioned that before.
I think I've heard of that.
Yeah. Yes. And so, you know, we were trying to improve accessibility of the base IDE. And there's a bunch of places where there's all these shortcuts taken, so you can just sort of quickly tab through things. And so the IDE was deliberately skipping things like the browse button next to text field, because you just want to go from text field to text field. You don't want to be sort of annoyed with these extra things on the screen that you probably would just click on if you wanted to. But of course, that's not great for screen readers or you know, navigating through the UI exclusively with a keyboard. So we had to sort of try to detect whether how we could solve this for both types of users, right? To sort of optimize keyboard flow, but also make everything reachable. And I wonder if this sounds like one of those trade-offs, right? If everything on the screen is clickable, there was probably a reason for that, but you maybe also want to find a way for accessibility software to reason about it.
I guess a lot of times when something's marked clickable, I call them a decoy clickable view. It's something that pops up and is like, would you like to click on that? And it doesn't really make sense. It's typically because something's been wrapped in something else, or like a button was clickable and then somebody said, well, I'm going to change it just a little bit, put something in. And so the its parent ends up being clickable and having the same bounds.
Was that just done so that they could make the, well, not with the same bounds, but I imagine sometimes you don't want to make a really small click target because it's harder to touch. So you might make the entire parent clickable, and it kind of, if you tap anywhere near this thing, it'll take it anyway, right? It's kind of cheating.
Yeah.
But I wonder if that's the kind of situation.
So that can't, there's a sort of another way to make views to sort of enlarge small touch targets. But I think a lot of the reason that these clickable things end up being sort of decoys is because automated tools may be sort of automatically constructing a bunch of things, and it becomes, there may be a bug in the tool that's constructing it rather than somebody deliberately making a particular view clickable. But to go then to the point you raised of small touch targets, that is an issue for somebody with a motor impairment or a tremor, or there's any number, the sort of variety of types of users is really, that's been one of the sort of fascinating things about this area. But if you want to make a touch target bigger, the sort of core way to do that is with a touch delegate now, unless you want to just make it bigger, that would work. But if you want the effective touch bounds to be different from the visible bounds, the touch delegate is kind of the way to go.
How does that work? So let's say I have a layout, right? And I have a button in it. And visually, I'm trying to match some UI spec, right? So let's say the button just has to be, 20 by 8 dips or something like that. So it's reasonably small. But I do know that there's some padding around it visually. And I would like that to actually also be able to sense a finger.
Yeah.
So is there a place there where is there like a touch delegate attribute, or is this something I do through code?
You pretty much do it through code. And so you can add a touch delegate to that view's parent and give it a set of a bounds and a view to delegate to. And the touch delegate will, the parent will check for a touch delegate, will then sort of hand the touch event off to that delegate, which will then pass it on to the view.
And then
all right, I have a feature request for the toolkit team, if we know anyone on that team, chat. This should be settable in XML. This feels to me like it's just to be part of the markup.
You're saying that there are portions of our API that are not synonymous
yes.
in XML yes. as well as...
Yes. Let's not do that.
That's news to me. Okay, I'll take that feature request. So if you're setting a touch delegate, then that does not cause the problem you were talking about with, let's call it the on-clickbait, where like then that parent is not clickable, so the sight-impaired user is not going to get too much information about the container because it's still about the button and not the container itself. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
I like on clickbait as a title for that problem.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
So I wonder if there are other things. I assume that there are a lot of heuristics that you have in the accessibility framework where you're making decisions about whether to propagate information to the user or not. For example, there's deeply nested layouts. If the layout is not visible and doesn't have a click listener, is that basically the heuristic for user does not need to know about this?
Yeah, we have, so there's a thing called importance for accessibility. And like often if there's a lot of different layouts that are sort of just containers to kind of move where things are visually on the screen. If they don't really do anything, we consider them not to be important for accessibility.
Right.
And we then don't report them to accessibility services with the exception of they can actually ask and say, we want everything on the screen. But that's really just to sort of simplify the amount of data we're moving back and forth between the app process and the accessibility service process.
Right. But I mean, it's not just about like conserving the bits. It's also about flooding the user with too much data because otherwise then they have to wade through all of this
linear
audio
layout,
information.
Linear layout.
Yeah. Although I think that goes to sort of what's the division of labor between an app and an accessibility service. So I'll define an accessibility service. I think we already know what an app is. So service, an accessibility service is a specific kind of app that is running. It's a foreground service that's long-lived, that's specifically enabled by the user, and is granted the sort of permissions to see what's going on the UI.
TalkBack. Can we use that as an example?
TalkBack is a good example. Switch Access is another example. Okay. There's Voice Access. We've got a bunch that we produce at Google, and then there's also others, third parties. That
a vibrant
that
ecosystem of external accessibility.
Yeah, we'd love to have a more vibrant ecosystem. I think that's sort of the power of having a pluggable API like this.
Are they all competing sort of for the same feature set, or are they optimized for different types of modalities? Like one is really optimized for helping you if you can't see what's on the screen. Another one's helping you if you have issues navigating. Or are they really just like two different teams that think they can do a better job than each other?
No, there's not. There's tremendous just diversity of types of disabilities.
Right.
I came to Google, my family member with a motor impairment and a visual impairment. So I thought I probably knew a lot about accessibility. And a lot of what I learned once I got here was how little I really knew, because his visual impairment is quite different from many other visual impairments. Something like if somebody can't perceive light at all, that's a fairly easy thing to reason about.
Right.
You can picture it. You can imagine, close your eyes and sort of figure out how you would navigate the world. But there's other things of different ways that things that can happen in the eye that affect like peripheral vision, but not central vision, or central vision, but not peripheral vision. My son has got a condition called cortical visual impairment, which is in the visual cortex. And so I still have no idea actually how he perceives things. I just ended up having conversations with him about what he can and can't see and what we could do to make it easier for him to see. And so as far as trying to help different types of users, there's a lot of people often need very different types of help. And in fact, sometimes things we do for one set of users end up being exactly the wrong thing for another.
I see. And that's why you would pick different types of accessibility services
Okay. And that's why I think having an open API like this will let folks who maybe know somebody who has a disability that's not well served by the services that are already out there could write their own. So we actually have a code lab to try to get people started to do that kind of work.
Okay.
That's one way to scale this to all users.
Okay. All right. So I think I kind of interrupted. You were explaining what an accessibility service was.
Yeah. So that's what an accessibility service is an app that tries to do that, and it gets access to what's going on the screen. And to sort of where Chet was going with the question, what app's job is to tell the accessibility API, here's what's going on the screen, and here's sort of the things that could be done on the screen. And it's up to the app then to say how much of this is of interest to the user. And so if you did flood the system with information, it's then we'll use TalkBack as an example if they're trying to help users who can't see the screen. They sort of own the problem of, well, okay, what do we read to the users? We've got all this text on the screen, and that's where like a user can touch different parts of the screen and they'll read different things to them.
So all the smarts of figuring out, oh, these are just nested linear layouts, that is what the accessibility app would do. It would try to reduce the complexity.
Yeah, okay. That's the kind of thing. And I think the right place to put, that's kind of where you want the complexity, is like someone who understands the user and is sort of motivated to make sure that we're serving them well. That's the people you want thinking about what's the right level of complexity to sort of expose to the user, as opposed to having everybody in the ecosystem try to figure out, okay, for all the accessibility users in the world, which ones are going to be concerned about this particular linear layout or that particular one.
Right. So the default is for the app to communicate as much data as possible to the accessibility service so that they can make smart decisions based on whatever they're trying to do.
Yeah, as much correct data.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing that, to the point that Chet started with is, you know, like a content description, because a picture is worth 1,000 words. Usually a picture is worth 1,000 words, but what a button is going to do does not require 1,000 words. It often requires one word, which is a verb.
Yeah.
So like an edit button makes sense to say, you know, edit, and then let TalkBack worry about telling the people it's a button or what the different actions are, as opposed to, this is a yellow pencil with a really pointy tip and it's got a pink eraser. And, you know, I spent a lot of time building this pencil. I thought about a green pencil.
Yeah.
You know, you could spend this, but that's where at least thinking a bit about the user experience, where a TalkBack user isn't necessarily going to want to hear the story of this icon every time they happen to tap that button.
Right. So it's interesting. There's a pretty clear division between the kinds of developers that you, Phil, are trying to appeal to, right? So there are there's the vast majority of developers, which are the people writing the applications and them knowing exactly how much information to provide such that when there is a user using a service, they're getting the right information to use the UI, regardless of, you know, impairments and situation. And then there's the other type of developer, which is a very small but important niche. And these are the people writing the services like TalkBack or the external services you listed. And I guess serving both of those needs, like being able to write a really powerful thing that serves very different use cases, versus also just trying to simplify things for app developers. Because if you are an app developer without a visual impairment, how are you supposed to know, how are you supposed to, you know, think about this ahead of time? And I guess that's part of your job, is making sure that developers do know this is an important thing. These are the cases that you really need to think about. These other ones, the framework will handle automatically for you.
Yeah, and I guess if a developer is using standard UI widgets the way that they were designed to be used, they ought to get a good accessibility experience out of the box. That's our goal. And so if somebody's doing that and they're having accessibility bugs that are something other than needing to label something here or there, they should probably start, you know, complain to somebody, rather than trying to, if you start writing elaborate workarounds for things in the framework, I'd much rather that we fix them in the framework, because that way we can make them work for all developers, not just those who are going to go that extra mile.
Are there examples of that, of people actually putting in workarounds to help accessibility services?
Yeah, we had sort of an unfortunate issue with clickable spans. It was actually something we very recently fixed, where they just didn't work, because in order to get the information from the app process to the accessibility service process, we have to parcel these things. And clickable spans aren't parcelable. Turns out URL spans are, clickable spans aren't. And that just kind of sat there for a while. And eventually for O, we went through and kind of plumbed everything through so that we could, you know, create a clickable span that worked for the accessibility service. They can call on click, and then we basically pass that information back through the framework and go back and find the original span and click on it. And so we did that in Android O. And so something just went from requiring pretty elaborate workarounds. I've seen people expose virtual view hierarchies around their clickable spans in order to make things work, to you don't have to do anything.
Well, I imagine that right now they have to do if SDK and less than O, complex code, else simple code.
Yeah, we just checked in the backporting for that into view compat.
Nice. Oh, fantastic.
Okay. So
that's great.
There's one line which is like, I'm not going to get the API wrong, but
that's
view
even
compat
better to
enable
know.
Clickable spans for accessibility, something to that effect.
So you talked about virtual view hierarchies. This is one area where I know developers may need to do more work if they have decided that, you know, custom views rock, right? So they're going to create a custom view for their really detailed thing because, you know, they didn't like the overhead of the, you know, little views, or they, whatever reason it was, now basically they have an entire view hierarchy or sub-view hierarchy defined within a single custom view. And at that point, the accessibility service or the accessibility framework doesn't know what to do, right? It doesn't know that little bit of text in there is a clickable object, because you're going to handle one click for the entire custom view and then sort of do your own management inside of that.
Yeah. So for developers who are just going to use things kind of the way we intended them to be used, I'm hoping that there should be virtually no work. The other extreme is what you're describing, where you just say, okay, the whole screen is one big view, and I'm just going to manually draw everything. Yeah. I'll handle all the touch events myself. And that's where we have accessibility delegate and accessibility node provider will expose essentially your own accessibility information. And that's right. A significant amount of work, but so is building the original UI. And so we have some documentation online of how to do that process.
It's basically providing a shadow tree of accessibility information, which otherwise would be provided automatically by the Vue framework.
Exactly.
Adam on the toolkit team has expressed like custom views thusly, which is, if you realize that the user is going to interact with a thing, then that should be a view, right? Just it, like a general idea, if you're looking into the world of custom views, like at the point where one of those things inside your custom view is going to be ripe for interaction, maybe you should reconsider that and not be doing custom views at that larger level. And then it you know, then you don't have to do as much work for accessibility to just work.
Yeah, and probably don't have to do as much work in a lot of different ways.
Right, right. Like it used to be, you know, a soft recommendation for some situations for, you know, performance and avoiding memory overhead and method call overhead, like way back in the old Dalvik days. But it is no longer the case where, you know, we really encourage anybody to write these really complex custom views that shouldn't make sense in most situations. The other one I wondered about was web view. Is that also a situation where they end up having to do a lot of work, or is there enough accessibility handled through the general web view mechanisms?
So WebView is doing the virtual view translation automatically.
All right.
It's a significant amount of code in WebView to translate. They basically try to translate anything on the web into what would this look like if it was native Android, and then what would the accessibility hierarchy look like if it were all implemented as a native hierarchy.
Yeah, just back to the custom view issue for a second. So I'm thinking that, for example, if I have a custom view that is a calendar or date picker, right, that maybe has like a calendar customizer, I guess if I just build it with standard widgets completely, it'll work, sort of, but it'll not be very satisfying for someone using a screen reader, I would think, right, with, you know, maybe 30 little text views for each date and so forth. How often would you say it's valuable for someone to go through and actually implement accessibility services, you know, or I don't remember what the term is, right? But you can sort of have a helper class for a custom view. That is sort of the thing that talks to the accessibility service. How often would you say that's something that people should be doing?
I guess my goal is to have that be, the answer be as little as possible.
Because developers won't do it? Is that the worry? Or because I would think that users of the UI is going to have a much better experience, I would think.
Yeah. So I guess if you're, I guess I would start that with a user study.
Okay.
Like, go find, I wouldn't start doing that without having first had, like, okay, we're going to help users who have a visual impairment. I would, unless you really know a lot about users with visual impairment, I would go find some people with visual impairments and put the UI in front of them and see if it really is annoying. Sometimes our intuition, if we're not sort of first party users of these things, is really bad. So I would first just, if you're going to start doing more exotic things, I would first make sure that you're actually helping the people you are, you're trying to. Another thing that may be related to what you're saying is the problem of just how to group different things. So if you have a little bit of text in a lot of different places, we do have some attributes, both using focusable and to try to, and screen reader focusable to sort of specify which things should be considered a group if for like layout reasons a bunch of text is rendered in different places, or sort of the canonical example is sports scores, where you probably want to keep, you don't want to just read all the team names and then all the numbers, want to make sure that they're grouped in a reasonable way.
Columns are kind of tricky, I would think. And that's probably where the accessibility app can sort of apply their own smarts and try to figure out the actual layout on the screen. And, oh, this is adjacent to that, so it might be a label for that, even if the developer didn't helpfully say, label, the, you know, this text view has a label over there. Because there's an API for that, right? Setting
label for. Yeah, there is a label for API. And there's also these grouping APIs. And, yeah, services do the best they can, but it ends up being heuristics, and trying to come up with a heuristic that works across Android is tricky. So
we talked to someone, Felipe, about the autofill framework.
Yep.
And they, I think, had quite a few heuristics as well, because you want autofill similar to accessibility just to work out of the box without developers having really cooperated well. But on the other hand, you know, you need some heuristics to make sure you don't have false matches, and you can understand what, like, this actually must represent a password, or this is a username or an email address and things like that. And I don't remember all the heuristics they were talking about using, but I wonder if some of them would be interesting for accessibility as well.
Yeah, I tend to put those, I think I feel like the heuristics belong in the services where they can be updated when they turn out to be wrong.
Yeah, I think the challenge is that sometimes maybe you need more data from the app than is being communicated. So I think, I don't know if they do this, but one of the things that I think could be interesting is to look at the actual ID of a widget, right? So it's not available in code, but it's there in the, you know, in the resource table when you inflate the layout, for example. So that might tell you, hey, the name of this text field is phone number. Right?
Yeah, it might tell you that in the language that the developer developing it used, but
it
doesn't
an integer by the time the service is seeing it. So
we can get the text out of it.
Okay.
Yeah, there is actually an accessibility service API to get that to get that text and do the reverse mapping. There's actually a flag on the service so that they don't all get the overhead of doing that, but they can get to that information.
That API makes it really hard to do resource shrinking because, you know, it's hard to know if a resource is really unused because people can use the quote-unquote reflection API to look up resources by name.
So I was curious, going back to some of you said earlier where we encourage and would like an even larger ecosystem of these external services with lots of different use cases. I was curious about, like, you said the API is really open specifically to enable this so that you can write all kinds of different things. So what does the API provide for this openness? And do you have examples of like different kinds of services? As Tora was saying, like there are different domains that are interesting to serve. Like they're not all trying to serve the same problem or the same solution. So can you elaborate?
Yeah. So the basic API does a lot of things. It's an API surface. But the two main things are what is going on the screen, like what is on the screen, what actions are on the screen, and when does something change on the screen. And with that, the service can start to alert the user if something's changed. If they can't see the screen, then you can start to make announcements when things change on the screen that they might be interested in. The other one is just to take actions on their behalf. So I can sort of explain, TalkBack works essentially that way. That's what the users it tries to serve. Another service that we have is called Switch Access, where sort of a canonical user for Switch Access was Stephen Hawking, where he was using a device to sort of send a binary output, I believe by twitching his cheek muscle. And if you stop and think that all the amazing things that Stephen Hawking did, all that information had to traverse that information channel, it's sort of amazing to think about. And so, but that's done by offering, you know, do you want to click on this thing? Do you want to click on that thing? One or sometimes a group of clickable objects at a time. And so that's something that's really not so much describing what's on the screen, but just taking advantage of the actions.
Yeah.
I recently wrote something for my son. He was having trouble clicking a particular button that was just something that is in his way. And so I wrote a little service that would just, after a certain amount of time, click this button for him. And that was just, you know, he doesn't really need Switch Access. He doesn't really need TalkBack. He does use our Select to Speak service a bit. But it was one particular thing that he was just really stuck on. And so I was like, you know, I know a guy who works on the API for that, so I'll be right back. And so we went through and just fixed this one little thing for him. There's third-party services that use head tracking. So they track how somebody moves their head around and then use that to sort of to drive like where a virtual finger would be on the screen.
Okay.
And this is something that was done by a third party. It was sort of using an API that we originally built for Switch Access.
Are these services that can be run in parallel? Can they be layered?
They can all be run in parallel. The one challenge there is typically if you're trying to solve a problem for somebody because of their disability, a lot of times you ask, well, what are they able to do? And then you start sort of leaning more heavily on that in exchange for trying to shore up whatever they're having trouble with. And so often the experience that somebody who's got multiple disabilities needs ends up being different from the sum of two things to help each individual service, but they certainly can run in parallel, just they have a way of conflicting with one another. So like, for example, somebody has both a visual impairment and a motor impairment. Switch Access has actually implemented an audio feedback version, which is different from what TalkBack would say, because the needs of their users ended up being subtly different.
Okay. I'm going to switch tracks again. Testing. So there are two things that occur to me in testing. One is, okay, so you're a developer that wants to provide an appropriate level of accessibility for your application. Great. How do you test that? You know, as you said, it's hard to imagine what the problems would be. Therefore, it's hard to imagine whether you have solved that experience appropriately. The other one is like very different, but I believe historically testing frameworks would use the accessibility framework that we developed because that was the way, as you said, you can take actions on the UI, right? You can see what's there and you can do stuff to it, and that turns out to be kind of important for testing applications. Can you talk about both of those?
Sure, we can talk about the second one first, which is you know, our UI automation API is essentially an accessibility service that's been stripped of a few things that we didn't think a UI automation would actually need, or that instrumentation provided a better avenue for anyway. And yeah, so building up annotating information correctly for accessibility can end up helping UI automation-based testing.
Yeah, it ended up being like a workaround for the issue where we didn't sort of build in that UI automation in its own right, I guess. I don't know when this came online. It existed when I got here. Was that in 1.0? Were we using accessibility for that purpose?
I am not positive what the history is, but it would pretty much have to, it's built on top of accessibility, so it would have needed to be in, you know, after the accessibility APIs were put in, and I'm not positive when the first versions of those went in.
Yeah, okay.
The first version of accessibility looked quite different from what we're currently using.
Right.
So I'm not positive when that got done.
And is that still, like, if you were going to write a UI automation layer from scratch right now, would you end up doing the same approach, or do we provide enough hooks that that is just a hacky workaround?
I'm trying to think, would you want to rebuild it from scratch? Like Autofill rebuilt it largely from scratch because they had there's some performance penalty in generating all this information for accessibility, and they didn't want to add that overhead to every user on the planet in order to get this small amount of information. So they kind of optimized it down for testing. I guess I would think probably you want all the information and you're less concerned about the performance. So it might be the right way to do that. That's also, it's done on other platforms as well, where it's built on top of the accessibility infrastructure.
It's just that they have very similar needs.
And there's just this nice synergy there where if you really want to make sure your app is fully testable, well, it'll also be fully accessible.
I just want to point out that you used both the word modality and synergy today on the podcast.
Leveraging the synergies of modality.
Okay, well, I was impressed, and now I'm horrified. All right.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't say just because you've got good test coverage doesn't mean that it's going to work for a user, because the UI automation has got its needs are whatever you programmed its needs to be, as opposed to a person who, you know, might need some labeling. That kind of goes to Chet's point of how do you know that this is working well for a particular set of users?
It's just, you know, at least for the way we do UI automation testing with Studio, we have this internal rule that tests aren't allowed to sort of go to do things that a user couldn't. So you can't go and fish in the hierarchy. No, I'm sorry, I said the wrong thing. You can't go and like look at the code and directly invoke methods. You have to get to a visible button and click that, right? So that's one of the sort of the rules we have when we write tests, but it does make sure that that this button is actually present and you can get to the functionality via the UI. You can't just sort of sidestep the issue. And so if you write your test that way, it's more likely, I guess, that your test will be fully, drivable from the UI, which is what accessibility needs as well.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, that's one of the rules we have for the accessibility API is
application context, call find view by ID, find a thing.
Yeah. Well, I've introduced and fixed bugs that was possible to do something, usually something fairly subtle on the screen that actually was impossible to do if you were touching the device. And we wanted to make sure that we don't accidentally kind of give accessibility users too much capability, partly because that's all capability that probably the developer never thought about. So like if you start being able to do things that they were never able to test for, you're likely to have something weird happen.
Right.
But in the question of how do we make sure that accessibility is going to work well for a particular set of users, there's really only one way to know that for sure. And that's to go find some users and sort of see how it works for them, do a formal user study. That's also the heaviest possible way to do that. Yeah. It's a significant investment. And so One way to find bugs more quickly is to use automated tests for accessibility. And we've got some tools that we've built that can find really things that are clearly bugs. So if there's an object on the screen that says that it's actionable, it can be clicked or it can be long clicked or it has some other action associated with it, it then needs to be labeled. Otherwise, you're essentially a talkback user would be saying, like, would you like to click this thing? I don't know what this thing is, but maybe you'd like to click it. So that's something that's clearly a bug. It may be one of these, I call them decoy. What's the word now? Clickbait?
On clickbait.
On clickbait, yeah. Views. And so in that case, the bug is just, you know, it shouldn't be clickable, or so it should either not be clickable, or it should be, or it should be properly labeled. And so you can find rules like that that, we pretty much, if you've done this, this is clearly a bug, and those tests can be automated. And so
it should also be a lint rule.
Well, we do have some lint rules, but there are, I think, I'm under the impression that we have some sort of espresso testing framework integration where it does this stuff on the fly.
Yeah, actually similar tests.
Exactly. It's one of the things that lint can't do is, for example, tell you that this widget on the screen has a foreground color and a background color that are almost the same. Because it sort of requires dynamic analysis and see what's going on. You don't really know that statically. So the thing we will do statically is tell you, hey, here's this layout, and you're putting it edit, you know, a text field there, and there's there's nothing. So then we flag that, hey, you should set a content description. But, you know, some of these other more dynamic things, you know, lack of focus traversal, those things. Right. I thought, isn't there some espresso rule that?
Yeah, that can be done with espresso.
Is it automatic?
Accessibility validator. So it's not automatically built into Espresso. It needs to be turned on.
I see. So everyone, action item after this podcast is to go to your Espresso tests and basically make some extra API calls in this test setup. And at that point, when it runs through the UI tests, it'll do some extra accessibility checking and tell you if you have problems. Is that roughly how it works?
That would be great. Yeah.
Okay.
This thing, the class is called Accessibility Checks. And yeah, it's built into Espresso. It's built into Roboelectric.
I wonder why the default isn't true.
I'm curious though. I think of Espresso as being APIs and utilities for creating tests, right? Like that. Okay, that's going to help me find that view and do some action on it. But it sounds like there's
Espresso's
a more general
actual,
thing that you can just run.
It runs the test. Like so, yes, we have an Espresso test recorder in Studio, which builds the test. But when you actually have a test, you run it through Espresso, and it has all this extra stuff for like grabbing a screenshot if there's a failure. And what makes it really special is that it knows how to drive your UI through all the critical journeys through your UI.
Right.
So it'll have the application in the right state, and then it gets to run code to check stuff out, and that's where it can go and not just assert that what your code is doing is correct according to your assertions, but it can also say, hey, do we see anything on the screen that looks really iffy? For example, contrast problems.
But you need to actually create that test,
yes.
You know, through the recorder
yes.
or through manual
yes.
tests or whatever, you need to create the test. But is there something more automatic that can basically just run through your entire UI and take a look at it and generate these problems?
How could it?
I don't know.
What if the first screen asks for a password and then it doesn't know how to proceed?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there are cases that we can't cover it, but for like Espresso, we do check if you're clicking on the view with Espresso, we can also see, well, could you click on it with accessibility? And Roboelectric, similar kind of integration.
Okay.
But when you're talking about walking the UI, that is actually something we've built into, we launched recently in the pre-launch report on Google Play, where there's actually an accessibility section, and it will do some level of walking through the UI looking for trouble.
That's pretty cool. So this is in the, do they call it vitals? It's one of those sort of reports you can get on your app. Or do we like block post? No, we wouldn't block, but it's just informational for the developer to find out that this was a problem.
It's just informational.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it's in the release management section in Play. Okay.
It's something we've been thinking about doing in Lint as well. It wouldn't have the same nice attribute of the pre-launch report in that it's actually running your app. And so if you do dynamic things, it'll also show up. But what we're thinking of doing is to actually take all your layouts and inflate them just like the layout editor would and run layout lib on it. There's some things we could find out. For example, your touch areas are too small or, you know, in many cases, there's contrast problems. The downside is we would be initializing layout lib also during your build, you know, your lint runs, which is going to make it even slower. And that's not very popular.
People thought our builds were too fast and they wanted them to be slow.
Yeah, yeah.
Did I get that wrong?
So this is another feature. Yeah.
Okay.
No, so I mean, my philosophy, and I've said this before, right? Like the build should be fast, but that's not the goal for Lint. Lint is you run it on the CI server and you're trying to use it to help find bugs. So whether it takes 1 hour or 4 hours is less important, I think, than whether or not it finds additional bugs and problems.
Right.
And so I think it's worthwhile for us to also add these accessibility checks. And so, you know, they probably will appear at some point.
So you were partway through a description. So there's telling Espresso to run in this mode where it flags these accessibility issues. There's the Play Store. Is that the overall approach people should take for their apps?
The third surface is a specific app called Accessibility Scanner. And that's something where it mounts itself as an accessibility service on the device. And then you gives you a little button that you push the button and it will take a snapshot of the UI and just look for problems.
Oh, cool.
And so that's something that can be done outside of the code development process by like a product manager or anybody.
But you have to invoke that over and over for each screen.
Yeah.
Okay.
So is that something we provide?
Yeah, Accessibility Scanner. It's on, you know, it's on Google Play.
Oh, okay.
It would be cool if it could just sit and monitor the UI, kind of like the, what was that service we added? Google on Tap, right? When you long press the home button at some point, and it would sort of grab your screen and look at stuff.
If it looked at the context of what's going on.
Yeah. Right. I mean, if you could have something that is not just click over and over, but if it could just, I can just enable it, kind of like a screen reader, right? And then now it's just monitoring my UI and telling me if it sees anything dodgy, right? So that if you are a PM on the team, you would just turn this on when you're playing with the product. And if you suddenly happen to hit a screen where there's a problem, you might not have realized that, oh, the engineers changed something and now they broke it, right? Because this screen has been okay before. It would just suddenly tell you there's a problem.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea.
Continuous monitoring of problems.
Actually, or I was thinking of something you could have in the app as well. Like we talked to the PY about Leak Canary.
Yeah.
Years ago, where basically you sort of add this functionality into your app, and then it's basically going to sit there in the background and detect activity leaks and interesting memory issues as they happen in your app. So it's sort of something that you can run. You know, when you're dog fooding this debug
version. Yeah, you can get the feedback, and also you don't need to ask for special permissions, right? Because I assume that actually being able to monitor all the stuff on the UI is something you need special permissions to do. It's obviously a security problem.
Yeah, I would hope so. But like then you're in charge of installing this thing, and then it's not running on your device overall because I really don't care what, you know, that app did. I care about my app. So you run through your app, and then it could automatically report stuff. So yeah, we imagine that that would be a nice thing.
Yeah.
We'll get right on it.
I guess it's our favorite issue tracking mechanism. Yes. Of this podcast.
Feature request, write scanner, but in a much more invasive way, in a way that can be built into the app. So, yeah. Okay. I don't know. Would that be useful? Would a service like that be able to catch things that scanner could not? Is scanner not allowed some information that would be more useful for the developer to know if it had more direct access and permission to the apps?
I guess Scanner could probably do stuff that your app couldn't, such as looking at, you know, your notifications, the actual UI of notification, things like that, right, that are outside of your process.
Yeah.
Yeah, the nice thing about Accessibility Scanner is it's looking at it as if it were an accessibility service. And so anything it doesn't know is something a service wouldn't know. So it has that. I'm trying to think if there could be something, there might be something really clever we could do with knowing the context from the inside of the app, but I don't know, nothing's coming to mind right now, but there could.
Well, you could grab a stack trace of the offending code and say,
yeah, that's true.
Here's a custom view that was trying to paint and look, it's painting this color on this background color and here it is. Don't do that.
And then automatically tweet that result to just, you know, shame developers into
direct
doing the right
social
thing.
Media right. interaction.
Yeah. Yeah. This might also have some implications for APK size.
Yeah, no, I imagine this would only be in beta builds of things, kind of like Leak Canary, right? That's something you sort of enable, you hand it to your team, they are kind of run with it and let you know if there's a problem, but you certainly don't include it in the final binary. I assume people don't.
I would hope not. Yeah. That would be weird.
It's pretty costly.
So what didn't we talk about? You mentioned earlier something about a code lab for accessibility services. Is that like it's a tutorial available on d.android.com?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So we'll link to it from show notes. I assume that's self-explanatory.
Are there any top mistakes you see developers do? Any like if there was three things you want developers to remember from this podcast, what would they be?
I think the most common errors tend still to be labeling things. And
or not doing that?
Yeah, well, the first order problem is not labeling it. I think the second order problem is labeling it far too verbosely, that really what you want is a verb.
Can you give a specific example?
That was going back to the edit button thing.
The edit button,
yeah, that you want it to be edit, not... sort of elaborate description.
I wonder if your lint checks could be more intelligent about that. So actually, what are the lint checks right now for accessibility?
I'm trying to remember. I mean, there's certainly one around label 4, right? Saying that you should set label 4 if it looks
clickable.
I don't remember exactly what the trigger point is, right?
Right. It wants a content description if it's got actions. Yeah.
Yeah. There's certainly stuff around text fields. What?
Yeah. Could it be more intelligent about, oh, this is a button. This is an actionable item. Could it be an action verb, or is that a bit too much to expect?
Yeah. Like this is something that would be nice, right? It does not analyze the text of right now. It says, hey, it has some heuristics for deciding whether or not, for example, a text field should have a content description, right? And there's some reasons back and forth why it wouldn't.
Maybe same thing
for image view, you know, like whether or not it looks like it's important. It does not look at the text to decide whether that text is useful. Oh, there's one exception. If it's to do, it'll still complain because we have a quick fix that says, hey, you should set this. And the quick fixes, it'll actually go and insert attribute with the, you know, select the text to do. Yeah. If you leave it at that, it'll continue to warn until you actually set it. Yeah. But it would be nice if it could actually say, oh, you set this something really generic. This doesn't make sense. Or even better, if it sees the same description multiple times in the same layout, that is probably not right. Right. That's just laziness.
That's so, something that the accessibility tests do, is it checks if there are duplicate text on multiple views. There are, I think on Gmail at one point there was a fab for send and then there was another send button and they're both called send. And that's basically okay. They both do the same thing. You just don't want two different buttons with the same label to do different things because then it's sort of taking your chances.
Content description, foo. So it could at least be better about, I guess, like instead of analyzing the text, it could say, hey, you have a problem here. You know, this is an actionable item. Consider using a verb.
Yeah. Right?
So at least tell them, because otherwise,
I think writing the code to figure out if something is a verb in all the languages we support, that'll be really fun. So that's something I look forward to doing.
Machine learning. You type fast. and you do handle the image case. I was wondering about that as well. As a lint check?
Well, yes. I mean, basically, if you have an image view that doesn't have a label, we'll complain unless you've set, you know, important accessibility false. Yeah. Okay. Something like that.
All right. All right. So that was one, labeling.
Yeah. And I guess another flavor of labeling is if there's a section of the UI that is like using fragments to do full screen fragment transitions, you can add we call it an accessibility pane title to the...
This was new in
view.
In P, right?
It's new in P and backported to support library.
Oh, okay, great.
What is this called again?
Accessibility pane title. So this is sort of, if something looks like a window, sort of it's a part of a window that's acting like a window, so we called it a pane.
Exactly. In my head, it was P-A-I-N. I was like, oh, pane.
Well, there's some of that sometimes, but we're trying to minimize it.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, so it's like logical groupings of things. There was one for fragments. I thought there was another way of sort of logically grouping stuff for accessibility.
There's a few things for logically grouping things. There was this sort of screen reader focusable thing we added for P and again have backported. And that really has to do with the logic we had been using for grouping revolved around focusable. And the problem was sometimes people would start changing the focusable attribute and it would be helping, say, TalkBack users and making it harder for keyboard navigation.
Yep.
And so this screen reader focusable is really an attribute that can be manipulated when you don't want to mess with the keyboard focusability of something.
So actually, this makes me wonder, way back when I did desktop development, you would think about keyboard navigation focus and the focus order and like, you know, when I tab through the UI, what's going to happen. And I no longer think about that in the mobile space because I'm not using a keyboard, right? You're going to hit the button with your finger. You're not going to depend on, you know, a user hitting tab. However, it's really important if you're not navigating through by clicking the button directly, right? If you're using TalkBack and if you're navigating, you know, the items on the screen by, you know, swiping to the next one or whatever, you want to make sure that the order is somewhat logical. But like, how would the developers of the apps even know that they're kind of messing that up by the order in which they declare their UI or their layouts or whatever?
So aside from this outright grouping, like these things really should be read together, I feel like that really gets into like what does a screen reader user need? And that sort of is something that's kind of on TalkBack to make sure that the way that they've linearized the order makes sense.
But that would be up to each accessibility app, right? I mean, yes, they could just use the actual order of the children in the view hierarchy, but a smart one probably wouldn't. They would probably look at the visual order instead, I would hope.
I don't know. Like, does TalkBack have heuristics, or are these screeners in general? Oh, okay. All right. So hopefully they do something logically where the application didn't necessarily do that, you know, with their weird, you know, nesting of linear layouts or however they're laying out the screen.
Yeah. Weirdly nested things still can cause problems.
Sure.
But that's a case where I feel like the solution to that is probably for TalkBack to get smarter about dealing with it.
Yeah.
I feel like that can scale, because that way it needs to be fixed in one place. It's in TalkBack, that, as opposed to having everyone sort of ponder what the right order in which right traversal order is for each app.
But it still seems, I mean, if you were to imagine a table with cells, what is the right order in which to read it? It's not entirely clear, right? If it's column-oriented data or row-oriented data or what, right? So it seems like it's better if developers would use these APIs explicitly to group things.
Yeah. Well, for tables in particular, there's actually another attribute you can add to the accessibility thing, saying that this is a collection, and then these are items within a collection and where they are. So then, again, like, here's the data.
Yeah.
And you can say, oh, these are the headings. This is this is where you are in this table, and figure that then the, you know, if it's a screen.
Yeah. For a table, that makes sense. I was more thinking if you have a screen where things are kind of tabular, there's something, some top left, some stuff that maybe is related to it on the right, but it's not clear if it's exactly sort of meant to be read across or if they're sort of local. It seems like it'd be trouble in general to figure out from a screen, you know, what the correct order to process the data is.
Yeah. In that case, there are APIs to specify this, but I guess I think it tends to be corner cases when they're really needed.
Right. Okay.
So we covered two of the tips. There was the labeling and the grouping. And was there a third? He asked for three. I don't know whether that was fair or not.
Yeah. Well, I deal with these kinds of issues all the time. And I'm trying to think, like, what are the most common ones? I'll go with this sort of clickbaitable thing of if they're having actions that are just sort of added automatically for one reason or another that aren't actually wired up to anything.
Yeah.
That kind of really confuses switch access users, because you end up having to I still like my term decoy. Is there
okay?
There are things that are up there and people chase after them and they're not real. But it's something that can be kind of confusing to users, and if you're just thinking about one type of user, just thinking about TalkBack users, it's easy to kind of let those sort of things slide by. And so I think kind of making sure you're covering both sets of users is helpful.
And how would they find out about that other than using one of these screen readers and realizing it was reading way too much information? Is there, like, is Scanner going to catch this and say, what is going on with all the on-click stuff?
It's a tricky one to catch. Scanner does check if there are two things with exactly the same bounds.
Yeah.
Is sort of the most pernicious variant of this problem, because it actually will highlight the same thing. And like when they say, no, I don't want that one, I want the next one. The next one is exactly the same place.
Yeah.
It can become very confusing. Otherwise, you can just use switch access. I mean, you can kind of play around with it. It's actually something you can configure really easily using the volume keys of switches and just sort of see what the thing does.
Okay. So there's some automated testing stuff, and there's also just get one of these accessibility services apps and play with it a bit and make sure that it's sensible for what your UI is.
Yeah. And some of these, like TalkBack and Switch Access, Select to Speak, they ship on most Android devices.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but most of them.
Okay. What did we forget to cover? Oh, future. Where are things going? So you were mentioning on the way over to the studio this morning that thanks to Jetpack now being developed in AOSP, we're actually chucking stuff in that people can get a hold of pretty soon and can see what's going on there.
Yeah, so like this clickable spans thing I mentioned earlier is there, the accessibility pane title we checked in recently.
Yeah.
Something that's, I think, still in review is, it will probably be out within a couple of, it checked in within a couple of weeks. I'm not sure then what downstream when it becomes an official support library release.
We're recording this in 2014, but it'll be available hopefully by 2018.
Sounds good. the something to add actions onto views. So sometimes if somebody has overridden a touch listener, we then know they're no longer like, they don't have an on-click listener necessarily registered. So stuff is going on. In fact, maybe this should have been one of my three things. So there's actions that are available to users that there's really no way for accessibility to find out about. And it was, there was a fair amount of API surface you had to master in order to solve this problem. And so we've sort of wrapped all of that in a view compat method, which is called something like add accessibility action, which is, you know, here's a callback when this action gets performed, here's what the action's name is. And that's sort of enough information. That's really all the accessibility ever needed to begin with. And so you just provide the bare minimum of that. And then those actions will appear on a view for an accessibility user, a switch user, or a talkback user, or things like, you know, swipes or, you know, zooming in on something, multi-finger gestures that are otherwise quite difficult to, can be very difficult for a user to perform.
So interesting. You said, so we know when there's a click listener, but if someone actually just overrides on touch event, then that's just like too much information for us to wade through and figure out what's going on. So they could basically manually handle a click and you'd never know about an accessibility layer.
It's essentially the same thing as the views, this virtual view, that if you just start drawing your own UI on the screen, we don't know what it is. It's just one big canvas to us. If you've overridden the touch handling, it's kind of the same problem.
Yeah.
It's just a big area that people could touch, and maybe things happen. It goes off to your logic, and we can't like traverse through the code to figure out what the core actions are.
I wonder if is there like a lint surface area there somewhere? Like, because this wouldn't, I mean, obviously it makes sense as you talk about it now, but I wouldn't have drawn the clear distinction before, where it's like, I don't know, I just happened to write a manual event handler and I handled the tap as part of that. But
you know,
I do think
we have a lint rule for that. I now, and it was someone else who wrote it. Something about if it sees that you are, yes, there's some sort of thing where it notices that you're
handling it down and up, or
something. Yeah, I don't remember the heuristics now, but it's something about if it sees both a touch handler and a perform click, or I don't remember exactly, but there's something like that.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, for a cool thing to have would be some sort of tool that made it really easy to build custom touch handlers that sort of also subtly asked, like, by the way, what are the labels for these things? And then just sort of exposed it automatically to kind of go one step up. But at least what we've eliminated the need to find out what, to go dig into accessibility delegate and see how to add these actions. It's just sort of one line of, you know, add the action. Here's what it's called. Here's the method I'd like called back. And then it's all done.
That's cool.
Great.
Well, I learned a lot.
I did too. I'm going to go write some accessible code. Anything else?
I guess I have a general statement about accessibility. That there's, you know, we're talking about users with disabilities, and having a disability is sort of by definition a challenge. But another challenge that people face is the assumptions everybody makes. And I think as engineers, we quickly learn that assumptions are bad. But very reasonable sounding assumptions for people with disabilities, like, you know, I'm writing a photos system. You know, maybe somebody who's visually impaired, they're never going to care about this, so I don't need to do the accessibility. But, you know, we've built into camera the ability to take pictures, even if you can't see the screen. And so somebody who's, you know, so a user that it might be reasonable to think sort of off the top of your head wouldn't actually care about managing their photos. No, they're taking photos. They would like to manage them also, please. And so I think whenever you catch yourself saying, well, you know, someone who's got that impairment isn't going to be interested in this, that's an assumption you want to be very careful about and probably challenge, because that's, you know, there's 7 billion people in the world. That statement's probably false for at least one of them, and potentially for a lot more than that many people.
All right.
Yeah, it's a good note to end on.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.